Okay, well, hello everyone. Thanks as always for joining us here at the History 296 podcast. Hope this finds you well wherever you're at and whenever you're listening to this. So this week in the course, we will be turning our attention to South Korea after the war, the Republic of Korea, and particularly focusing in on the nearly 7 to 8 years that Syngman Rhee ruled in the 1950s. He would be eventually flee office with a resulting from a democratic uprising on April 12th of 1960. But that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. That's kind of where that's the area we're going to try to be focusing on. And it's one, you know, we say this every week, but it is certainly true. It's a period of upheaval, of dramatic transformations, of South Korean society trying to, in some ways, find its bearings, right? That Korean society and Korean culture and the Korean people as an ethnic group, as an identity, have obviously existed and persisted for millennia, well over 1,000 years, several thousand years, depending on how you want to define it. But at the same time, South Korea or the Republic of Korea is still an extremely new society, a new state, a new sovereign entity, and certainly one that is going to draw upon existing Korean cultural motifs and Korean history, but at the same time trying to forge this notion of, and going back to this theme we've hit upon throughout the course, you know, what is a Korean modernity, and tying it back to what we talked about last week with North Korea after the war, to the extent that we can follow paradigms set by Barrington Moore that looked at capitalism, communism, and fascism as kind of three routes to modernity for societies to travel along in pursuit of these kind of goals that we often associate with modernity or modernization. We can see that in South Korea, they're going to attempt to follow what we would call roughly the capitalist route, right? And trying to ally itself or find a place within the U.S. alliance system in the Cold War. Obviously, as we noted, one of the big outcomes of the Korean War was extremely deep connection and close connections between the United States and Korea that, as we noted, certainly didn't exist in the immediate post-colonial period during the U.S. occupation. And in some ways, that was one of the bonds forged by the Korean War and in many ways persists to this day with a large contingent of U.S. Soldiers and other personnel, American personnel within South Korea to the present day. And in the context of trying to think about this new society in South Korea after the war, settling in and trying to establish its identity, that is also, we can look back at another one of the major legacies of the Korean War was, as we discussed, it in some ways gave the South Korean government a source of legitimacy or a language, a story to tell that legitimated its rule and its function within the post-colonial, post-Korean War world, right? And that was one, namely, of protecting the people of South Korea and ensuring their liberty from what was seen as the dark and dangerous and malevolent forces of the communists, right? And establishing itself as this notion of a free Korean government set about to protect the people in South Korea, but also ultimately to liberate the people in North Korea, right? And it's important to consider that this was a major shift from just almost 10 years previous at the very end of the colonial period in the 1940s, in late 1940s. The government very much struggled to gather any sort of popular support, in no small part connected to things we've discussed, having so many people that were wealthy and therefore tainted with this branding of collaboration by many within society, that they were on very shaky ground. And the mass revolts and uprisings we talked about indicate that, right? And so in some ways, the Korean War was a mechanism through which, on the other end of it, the government of Syngman Rhee and the South Korean government more generally had a genuine anchor in terms of its legitimacy, and it was in many ways, again, to protect people from what was seen as a dangerous and dark force in the North. And so in this way, what we're going to really try to dig into this week, and I guess, you know, what I hope you can gather from the readings and our discussions in class and in the student-led class this week as well, is to think about what kind of core elements of South Korean society, which is dramatically different than it is, than it was in the 1950s. Every society is dramatically different, but notably South Korea, because it has now become such a wealthy and prosperous society. It is increasingly now a, you know, very culturally relevant society. Over the last 10 years, in terms of pop music and other television shows and movies, has really become a very prominent country on the world stage. And it's interesting to think that that would be hardly what one would have expected or predicted in the 1950s. Many outside observers didn't really give the South Korean regime much chance of even making it very long, right? It wasn't even clear that the regime after the Korean War was going to be able to persist because of the high levels of poverty and destruction. And in some ways that mirrored the situation in the North. But as we noted, they, as opposed to the North, there wasn't even a pre-existing industrial base to try to recreate. And so in some ways, South Korea was even in a more set of dire straits. Of course, they had U.S. aid and support, but that was limited and limiting, right? And in some ways, a lot of the social and political dynamics during the reign of Syngman Rhee after the Korean War was tied to dependence on U.S. aid and the government's use of that connection to U.S. aid and support to funnel money and benefits to its allies, right? And that kind of sowed the seeds for its ultimate downfall. So this was, again, a continuingly period of turbulence and political upheaval that would culminate in the democratic uprising of April 1960 and the eventual assumption of power of Park Chung-hee, who we're going to spend a whole class talking about in a few weeks, or actually, I believe next week. But even though that period of rapid industrialization, the 60s and 70s, is commonly focused on as a period of drastic transformation, I hope this week we can dig into some of the ways that a lot of the basis for what we know today as South Korea, or some of the key cultural and social and political and economic foundations of what would grow into what we again see as South Korea today, were present and in many ways established or set down during this period between 1953 and 1960. Okay, well, I'll leave it there for today. That's just something to keep in mind, right? How can we see present South Korea and issues and the shape of present day South Korea? How can we see some of the foundations? And that's one of the things I think is really useful and interesting about studying history, is that even though Korea in 1955 or 1954, South Korea was very, very different than what we see today, we're still able to identify, I think, key elements that and foundational elements that persist well beyond that period, and somehow, even though perhaps transformed or changed, persist even into the present day. And I think that's one thing I want you to focus on when you're doing the reading and looking at some of the notes and so forth for this week. Okay, well, have a great weekend, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Mm-hmm.